Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. This is our weekly Q&A with Layla, where we answer your questions, part two of a two-part podcast. And let's return to our questions, Layla, shall we?
Yes. I have a very interesting one here for you, Dr. Hoffman. This is from Anthony. Anthony is a social scientist. He says, I read your article on too much estrogen in the body. I was wondering, has there ever been a study conducted linking hormonal imbalance as a determining factor in the sexual orientation of the unborn child of a pregnant woman? Hence, making it a true belief of homosexuality, I was born this way. And he says, he confesses he's not a homosexual. One of my friends made the point that her parents took estrogen pills while pregnant. I'm simply a truth seeker, Dr. Hoffman. I was wondering if there's any truth to this statement. Thank you for your time.
Well, this is a very, very fascinating question, and I thank you for posing it, although it's a little bit of a sticky question because it has so many implications, and it's argued vociferously by both sides. You know, Lady Gaga's song, Born This Way, you know, an extraordinarily popular song, particularly in view of the gay rights movement, and I think this is actually one of the anthems of the gay rights movement. You know, the GLBT or whatever, however you whatever phraseology or terminology you use that's PC, is that this is not, it is act, the argument has been made by some that being gay is a lifestyle choice. And, you know, perhaps to some extent, you know, in a society where there's acceptance of gay sex and, you know, a partnership between people of the same sex, there is perhaps a little bit more openness, you know, society may be more open to that potentiality, whereas in the past it was repressed and kept under wraps and people weren't able to express their desires or their inclinations. But there are those who contend that you could actually cure gayness. And this is there was actually a terrible era in psychiatry used various types of aversive therapy and shock therapy. They would shock people while showing them pornographic films depicting same-sex sex to get people to be disgusted at same-sex sex and to recondition them towards the proper sexual inclination. In other words, there was just sort of something behavioral that you made a choice about, but you could be retrained. And this is a terrible era in psychiatry that actually lasted until recently. It was very popular in the 1950s, and there's still some rare instances of therapists who pledged.
I think they're more affiliated with religious groups
and
now.
They're affiliated with certain religious groups, you know, the belief is that the Bible, you know, has prohibitions against this. It's unnatural and so on and so on. So there are some people who contend that, no, you're not born this way, that this is simply a matter of a moral choice, and you can follow, you know, a moral lifestyle and the correct, you know. And that, of course, there's not a lot of biological basis for believing that there is, you know, that there is not some sort of inherent aspect to homosexual or same-sex behavior that isn't biologically determined. On the other hand, there actually have been efforts to look at the brains of male and female same-sex individuals attracted to members of the same sex to see if there is some distinctive area of the brain that was changed. In other words, is the brain of gay men more a female brain than heterosexual men, and there's some studies that suggest that. However, there's been some pushback against that too, because if you look at the spectrum of individuals who are gay or prefer same-sex partners, there's a wide variation in their masculinity or femininity. I mean, I think that that's just a matter of, you know, pure common sense is, you know, that there's some men who are gay who are very, very effeminate in their, their entire orientation is towards behaviors that are more associated with females, and the other who are just total macho, macho men, and very much, capable of serving in the armed services and in physical occupations that are very male oriented. So it's really hard to stereotype. And I think here's where the environment comes in. It is said that there are xenoestrogens and feminizing chemicals in the environment, and there's some animal research, for example, that shows that sexual behavior in animals may be affected by estrogenic chemicals, that mating behavior is changed, and there's hermaphroditism in crocodiles because they have ambiguous sexual organs because they swim in waters that are full of plastic chemicals.
I think frogs, too. Yes,
frogs.
Yes.
But this does not necessarily mean that that is what is the, quote, cause of the rise in people coming out and expressing same-sex behaviors. One could say, well, gee, if that's the case, men are becoming feminized. How come there's also an emergence of more lesbian or gay females? Is that because there's a masculinization of the environment? Well, how can you have – that's paradoxical. You have a masculinization of the environment due to masculinizing chemicals at the same time that there's a feminization. It doesn't make – that theory doesn't hold a lot of water.
Right.
So, what we can say is that there is an increase in reproductive anomalies among men. Young boys, that may be due to estrogenization. There's an increase in reproductive cancers among both men and women, breast, uterus, and prostate among, in tissue that's vulnerable to chemical effects. Could that be dietary? Could it be from chemical exposures? We don't know. But I think it's oversimplification to say that we're in an estrogenized environment, and that is effeminizing our culture and effeminizing our behavior. I'm not sure if that holds water, that theory.
Yeah.
Do you have any comments on that yourself?
No, and I was also thinking of the transgendered community as well.
Yeah.
What about them and so forth? But maybe the exposure is not always. Oh, the exposures during pregnancy definitely could be one thing, not in determining their sexual orientation, but for a whole lot of other ills and ails, as you're describing, but also the health of the father, the sperm, the health of the sperm. What have they been exposed to in the environment as well?
So the next time a male patient comes to me and says, I'm interested in a sex change operation, I'm just going to say, hey, just drink some city water. And microwave your food in plastic. And, you won't need a sex change operation. You'll I think we could carry this to absurd lengths. I'm not sure.
We could.
Yeah. All right.
Okay.
So, the controversial subject because, a lot of this is it PC to say this and I think sometimes people harness some scientific arguments to hook up their initial belief or prejudice one way or the other.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay.
I've got another question here from Barb. Featured on a local New York City news this past week. This is about APOS therapy, which I had a chance to look up. Supposedly a replacement for joint, especially knee surgery, reputed to be successful in parts of Europe and Asia. Perhaps worth your thoughts on a future show or podcast, to be a way around surgery for some and painkillers for nearly all of us. She says, enjoying the work you share with us. Many thanks, Barbara.
Okay. I looked it up, and it's interesting. APOS is a type of therapy. There's actually, you can see videos on the internet, and they did a news special on one of the major nightly news shows, so it got the word out about this. It's kind of weird because they give you special shoes that have adjustable divots on the shoes that are big sort of clunky divots. I just don't think This is not exactly fashion-forward footwear. You know, kind of big Frankenstein shoes that have these big adjustable divots that you put on to supposedly balance your gait. And then as you adjust your gait and as your gait normalizes or improves, then you get successively, smaller divots put on these special shoes. And it's said to help spinal problems and knee problems and hip problems. And it's all, I think, based on theories that are essentially have their origin in chiropractic, which is leg length disparities sometimes cause imbalances in the spine, the hips, the knees, the ankles, and that these can be addressed through the right kind of footwear. Podiatrists have been doing it with orthotics for a long time. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I'm not sure. Maybe I'm not getting all the nuances of this, but I think there need to be more studies on this. And some of this, I think, is probably a placebo effect. You know, if you're wearing these special shoes for a while and you have a pain syndrome, pain syndromes are very, very amenable to suggestion. And you may achieve some relief with this, but I'm not sure that this has been scientifically vetted that thoroughly. But, you know, I'm open to it. I'd like to see some more research.
Sure, sure. But in the meantime, for those with joint or cartilage problems, there's a whole slew of supplements.
Yeah, let's go over this.
That are wonderful, starting with fish oil, and more fish oil than usual for its anti-inflammatory and lubricating effects, glucosamine, chondroitin, ASU, curcumin, boswellian. What am I missing, Dr. Hoffman?
Oh, I think those are some of the major things. Some people use hyaluronic acid with oral hyaluronic acid, although that's somewhat controversial. Even vitamin D, niacinamide for people with knee problems. That's the
How well do you know Synvisc to be?
Synvisc is partially effective temporarily, and it's injected. And some people get relief for a short period of time. It's one way to stave off the need for knee replacement. But it's not a cure. It's more of a temporizing treatment, if it works at all, because it sort of plumps up the cushioning that's missing in the knee. But if you're bone on bone, you know, eventually you may have to pay the piper and get the surgery.
Hey, remember prolotherapy?
Yeah, sure.
Do you think that would be indicated?
I think prolotherapy is often worth a try. There are studies that suggest that it is truly beneficial. It's not something without scientific substantiation. And the principle is that the joints are wobbly, and by tightening up the connective tissue around the joints slide less and create less discomfort. And, you know, there may be something to that.
Yeah.
I don't do it, but I've seen it helpful, and then I've also seen it strike out. So it's one of those things that, you know, might be worth a trial of therapy before you go under the knife.
Right, right. The knife being the last resort. So I guess for many people, anything's going to feel at least a little bit better.
However,
an alternative to surgery.
Let me just say that I'm a big fan of orthopedic surgery when it's appropriate, and a hip replacement or a knee replacement can give a person a much-needed new lease on life. And one of the problems is that as we live longer and we remain healthier in our core, in our hearts, and in our internal organs, it's like our chassis wears out. You know, the electronics, the motor, you know, everything else is working. But if your chassis is worn out, you may have a relatively young cardiovascular system in a body that's racked with pain. And so there's a big discrepancy. At 60, you're one part of your body may wear out, but you may have longevity to 100. So I would suggest that people consider surgery, even people who are very holistically oriented, if they're very terribly afflicted with joint pain and immobility. And, you know, we work patients through this, you know, with the right nutritional support. They do the physical therapy, and they have marvelous results, and they're really excited about the outcomes.
And, you know, the knee and hip replacements have gotten so much better than they were 15 years ago.
Yes.
And last longer as well.
Unfortunately, there have been some missteps, that's kind of a pun, but there have been some mishaps and missteps, you know, the wrong kind of materials being put in, things that break down, things that release harmful chemicals. But I think they've gotten past most of those technical problems, and ultimately people get better joint replacements these days.
Yeah.
So it was worth the wait for those of you who held out this long.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, we have time for more questions.
Yeah, we've got one more question here.
Sure.
And this is about bats.
Bats.
And this is from Brian.
Bats? Okay. Did you say like B-A-T-S?
Bats. BATS, yes, like the ones that fly, not in baseball.
No, I'm thinking more baseball because I'm like just, I saw a very good Yankee game today. You know, the Yankees' new pitcher that they pay, I don't know, some gazillions of dollars for, he finally came through with a great win. I think he had 10 strikeouts, and he went 8 innings. Tanaka, that's that phenom from Japan that they recruited. This is a guy that 7 teams bid on, and finally the Yanks got him. But the first couple of games, we weren't sure that this guy was going to come through. But today, he looked awesomely good.
Wow. Brian says, some of the article's figures may be exaggerated, but it seems that bats, as well as bees, are trying to tell us something in recent years. And we seem not to care sufficiently to invest the time, money, research in large enough numbers to figure out what's happening. Dr. Hoffman, do you have any ideas to share with us? Thank you for your time. Well, remember, you know, the bee population has been going down, and there was a question about cell phone towers and things like that, but it may be other things like pesticides. You know, I remember being a kid out on the North Fork of Long Island. Mm-hmm. We had bats.
Yes.
There were bats.
Yeah.
And you know what? The mosquito population was not as big as it is. I don't see a bat anymore on Long Island.
Bats
but the
eat
mosquitoes. Forget about it.
Bats eat.
They eat mosquitoes. Yeah.
Yes, they do. Yeah. Well, you know, the last time I saw a bat was it was kind of scary because I was this is about probably about more like 20 years ago. I used to have a bird feeder on my property. And I went, I checked the bird feeder because I was going to fill it. And I saw something that looked really strange inside the bird feeder. You know, like, what's in the bird feeder? And it was a bat. And it was sleeping in the bird feeder.
Upside down?
And it was kind of compressed against the glass, so it looked pretty weird. And I thought, whoa, this is nuts. So I gently shook the bird feeder, and I awakened the bat. And it moved. And then it went... and just scare the hell out of me.
Yeah, they are scary.
Because they also carry rabies. And you know, the problem is you don't know if the bat that bites you or scratches you is carrying rabies. So once you have contact with a bat, they have you put you through a series of painful injections. It used to be much worse. The injections were into your abdomen. Now they're not. But it's nasty.
Oh.
So, you know, I could do less with bats. I mean, I think it's probably not that salutary a sign for the environment that there are fewer of these species. Bees, of course, very, very important for the ecosystem because they pollinate plants.
Mm-hmm.
And this may be a sign that our environment is being severely polluted or degraded, that these species are in decline. The bats are developing a weird fungal disorder. It's like it's called white nose disease of the bats. And they develop some kind of fungal infection on their noses. And it
sounds
actually
like Candida.
It sounds like Candida. It's like a bat Candida. Version of Candida. You know, it's like yeast infection of some kind. And that suggests that there's some sort of immunological problem that's rendering them more susceptible to fungal infections. And it's a mysterious disease, and they're kind of concerned about it. The other thing I'll say about bats is that in Africa, bats are probably the source of Ebola infections.
Oh, wow.
And they are a vector for the Ebola virus. And it's not clear how the bat virus gets into humans. But when I was in Morocco, I saw something really weird, which was a market. This is probably not recently. I was there many years ago, like 30, 40 years ago as a young itinerant backpacker, you know, in the day when you put a backpack on your back and you travel around the world. And I saw the bat market where they were selling bat meat. And so that's, yes. And that was weird. You know, I didn't try. I was into trying exotic things, but I didn't go there. And that may be good because, but because of the consumption of this type of meat or maybe handling the bats, coming into contact with the bats, the Ebola virus, which is devastating, is like 90% fatalities with this very, very serious virus, may have been transmitted into the human population. The only good news about Ebola is that because it kills so effectively, it's not a very good virus, and it usually burns itself out. Anything that kills so effectively, it can't be transmitted because everybody's dead before they're transmitting the virus.
I almost wanted to say that's funny. It's not, but yeah, that's
Isn't that weird? Yeah, it's from the virus standpoint, it's not a very effective strategy. A better strategy is like the cold or flu, you know, where people are not so debilitated, they walk around and expose a lot of other people to it. But a virus that, you know, kills you within 72 hours and, you know, with obvious signs that you have the virus, so people avoid you, like you're bleeding from every orifice because it's hemorrhagic, that's not going to be a very good strategy for disseminating a virus. How did we get there? Oh, we're talking about bats.
Okay. We were talking about bats, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And, you know, while you're at it, stay away from gorilla meat or monkey meat, because that's thought to actually may have been the origins of the transmission of the AIDS virus, but we're not clear.
Okay, so that's not the new protein either then.
That's not the new. It's paleo, but
it's
we don't want to go.
Paleo, but yeah. We don't not go, bat nor beast. Okay.
Right. So, I don't know, maybe they had it together when they invented the kosher laws. I don't think either of those things are considered kosher.
Yeah. Wow.
So, on that note, we'll wish everyone a happy Easter and Passover.
Happy holidays, everyone.
Happy holidays. And we'll be back next week. For those of you with questions, radioprogram@AOL.com. Gets you through to us with your question or comment, and we'll be happy to. We had interesting questions today. We'll be happy to field your questions on the air. Thanks very much for joining us. Thank you, Layla.
Thank you, Dr. Hoffman.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.